Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Back 9 Report. We come to you live every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. with all the news and events from around the world of golf. Normally, my co-host Carlos Torres begins the show, but tonight he's running some controls and will not be able to be with us live on the air. But not to worry, we have our super host, Kieran Clark, direct from the land that brought us the great game of golf, Scotland. Kieran, we're so glad to have you with us again this evening and look forward to your insight into the happenings from around the world of golf.
Well, thank you, Fred. And as always, it's a pleasure to come on the show and to talk golf with you guys. And, of course, Carlos isn't there tonight, but I'll talk golf with you. So I'm looking forward to it. The FedEx Cup starts this week. I'm told that is supposed to be an exciting thing. I'm not so sure, but it should be good fun. Let's go.
We're going to talk about that after a while. We're going to talk about the tournaments that happened last weekend. We're going to preview what's coming up in all around the different tournaments in the world. But right now, as we do every week, we begin the Back 9 Report with the Par 5 news. And the first item on the agenda this evening is the auction of the Nike golf ball that Rory McIlroy used to win the Open Championship last month. It was caught by an Englishman, Lee Horner, who consigned the ball to a golf auctioneer to be sold at auction, and it sold in the early morning hours last Sunday. The auction company said that the price paid for the ball is the second highest ever paid for a golf ball, narrowly missing what a collector paid in April 2011 for a vintage Bobby Jones autograph ball, $55,865. Rory's only brought about $52,000. There was a lot of interest in this ball, Kerry said. We had 22 different bidders from countries around the world, including Ireland, Australia, and countries in Asia. The auctioneer said that the buyer wanted to stay anonymous, but did disclose that it was won by an American. We know, Kieran, everything's bigger and better and more expensive in America. The ball, which has the word R-O-R-S, Roars, printed on it, was confirmed to be McIlroy's ball by its sponsor, Nike. The auctioneer said that not many tournament-winning balls have come to the collector's marketplace because they are either kept by the golfer or lost in a bag after the round. He said he hopes that the money generated from McIlroy ball will encourage golfers to save, to save the golf ball for some, and to be eventually made public in some future time. As for McIlroy, it seems like he's content with rewarding fans after his win. After winning the Bridgestone Invitational earlier this month, he threw his ball into the crowd also. Said Kerry, "This is Rory's thing. If he wins the PGA on Sunday, maybe some lucky fan might have another $50,000 golf ball." Now, on the other side of this also, Kieran and Carlos, the good news is that Mr. Horner, who sold the ball, can now afford to stay in Rory McIlroy's former mansion in Northern Ireland. An investor bought the place when Rory put it up for sale and is running it out for a mere £12,500 per week. Or if that's too pricey, you can just practice your swing for 2 hours for £95 per adult or £45 per child on the 14-acre gated plush estate in Moneyray, County Down. The developer, Gary McCausland, the new owner of this monthly million-dollar estate, has its own private lake, a floodlit tennis court, a private theater, and is available for golf fans or corporate outings or even you, Kieran, if you want to pony up the 12-5. Some movie stars have been to this estate, which is called Robin Hall House, and even Tiger Woods is known to have been in awe of the 9-hole golf course that Rory had built there, which evidently replicates every shot required to win each of the four majors. So the new owner said, when I bought Robin Hall House, it was originally as a private retreat for myself and my family, but I've literally had hundreds of inquiries from all over and around the world of people wanting to come and use the facility. So on the back of this huge demand, I decided to make it exclusively available. How very nice of him to share it for only $12.5 per week. Kieran, isn't that a wonderful thing? Now, also,
it's absolutely tremendous. He's so charitable. What a wonderful thing to do. And I must say quickly, Fred, is there any truth in the rumor that you actually submitted a bid for Rory's golf ball?
Well, I can't. That's secret. I'm not allowed to disclose that, Kieran.
Oh, dear. I heard you did, but we'll leave that to for the people to decide. And,
let's just suffice it to say my $10 bid was rapidly overtook.
That may have lasted about 3 seconds, I think, in the start of the process. But, yes, Mr. Horner, now he's got $52,000. He may be able to go and buy himself some Ryder Cup tickets now. And the Ryder Cup is, of course, fast approaching, with only 37 days remaining until the biennial contest between the United States and Europe begins at the Glen Eagles Hotel in Perthshire, my part of the world, of course, in Scotland. And tickets for such a huge event as this are always in such high demand. But despite that, 3,000 additional tickets went on sale yesterday. The tickets were returns from the event's commercial allocations, where they hand out tickets to corporates and sponsors and so on. And this will, in theory, of course, ensure that more of the regular golf fans, you know, people like me and you and so on, will be able to attend rather than those nasty corporate suit guys with the money. And Richard Hills, who is the Europeans' Ryder Cup director, he said, it's common for a small number of general admission tickets to return once the final round of commercial allocations are complete. We are delighted to be able to release these tickets to the general public. It is great news for the event, and it will add to the very special atmosphere that only the Ryder Cup can produce. Tens of thousands of people made the effort to register for Ryder Cup tickets last year, and while many were successful, many others were not. Therefore, we wanted to make these last tickets available to them as well as to people who haven't registered before. And tickets for the event, Fred, they range from £10 for under-16s on the practice days, Monday to Thursday, to a quite simply disgusting £145 for the final day on Sunday, and that is approximately $240. So, Fred, you know, if you do fancy popping over to Scotland next month to watch the Americans be on the end of yet another devastating defeat, then you still have a chance.
Well, you know, Kieran, I think those tickets came up because Tiger's not playing and Duffner's not playing and Dustin Johnson's not playing, and I think we're just going to have to send in a forfeiture because I don't think we got anybody left willing to play. So, hey,
you bring your clubs, Fred, if you came over. You know,
what's that?
Clubs.
You get my clubs, I'm in. Put me in, Coach.
Yeah.
Hey, on the PGA Tour, we had another DQ. You know, we had all those withdrawals from the PGA Championship. And now Cameron Tringali came forward last Friday and disqualified himself from the PGA Championship. Tringali would have finished T33, would have won $54,000, but he's ranked number 61 in the FedEx Cup and number 114 in the World Golf Rankings. But he felt he had a rules infraction. Evidently, it was on his mind. It was bothering him. So he contacted PGA officials, after talking to him, evidently he waved his putter over a ball. He didn't actually strike the ball, but he waved it over, and that was a violation. And so his words were, I have contacted the PGA of America and asked to be disqualified from last week's PGA Championship at Valhalla. On Sunday, I signed for a bogey 4 on the par 3 11th hole. While approaching the hole to tap in my 3-inch bogey putt, the putter swung over the ball prior to tapping it in. Realizing that I could be the slightest doubt that the swing over the ball should have been recorded as a stroke, I spoke with the PGA of America and shared with them my conclusion that the stroke should have been recorded. I regret any inconvenience this has caused the PGA of America and my fellow competitors in what was a wonderful championship. You know, Kieran, this never fails to amaze me that these guys do this. Yes, he has had a wonderful year. He's won, I think, like $1.4 million this year. He's in great shape for keeping his card for next year. And so $54,000 in the whole big scheme of things is not that big of a problem for him. But, you know, to have the honesty to come forward and do that, whatever the reason he did it, and it was the right thing, just to be commended. And it's just one of those things about golf that that you just have to like. And, Kieran, I believe you have an update for us on the status of the Olympic golf course that's under construction in Rio de Janeiro.
I certainly do, Fred, but I'll quickly comment on what you just said there, and I completely agree with you on the it's a great thing about the game of golf, the honesty, the integrity of the game of golf. And I think if I recall correctly, there was a story like that at the U.S. Open in terms of the qualifiers. A player came through one of the qualifiers before the U.S. Open, and a couple of days later, he felt something was amiss with his round and a shot that he didn't quite play right, and he maybe double hit it or something. I can't recall that exact ruling, and he called the USGA and said, you know, I did that, so disqualify me, and he gave up a place in the U.S. Open potentially that year. So, you know, these stories do happen in golf, and it's a good sign for the game. And, yes, on to the Olympics, and this has really been quite an unfortunate saga, Fred, you know, and golf will make its return, of course, to the Olympic Games in 2 years' time in Rio in Brazil, where the World Cup soccer was just held in the summer. But the construction of the golf course has been a tumultuous process. However, things may just be going in the right direction now, maybe. Rex Hoggard reported on the Golf Channel website that the course was now apparently 59% complete, which I must say, it does seem awfully specific. You know, I don't know how, perhaps another bunker would edge it to 60% maybe, I don't know. But the course, which has been designed by renowned architect Gil Hance, has suffered a succession of delays in the past couple of years. But this is the most obvious sign of progress actually happening, with images taken even showing the evidence of some growing grass, which was certainly not there before. So that's progress. And the growing process is expected to take another 11 months, which, of course, doesn't really leave much time for the course to be tested ahead of the Olympics in less than 2 years' time now. And the Rio Olympic Committee have released a tentative schedule, which does include a competition to be played on the Olympic golf course next August in 2015. And this will most likely be a PGA Tour Latino America tournament, which will give us an indication as to how the new course will likely play during the Olympic Games in 2016. And the international golf president, Ty Votaw, said last month at the Open Championship that we feel that the landowner and developer needs to continue doing what he's doing over the last few months to continue this momentum and move from a construction stage into a grow-in and operational and maintenance stage. If they do that, we feel that the schedule is certainly achievable. So there is still an element of doubt there. It's not a guarantee that things will go quite so smoothly, but somehow these things have invariably somehow come well in the end in sporting event terms. But you know, it's one of those things we'll have to wait and see, but it's been a difficult process. A pretty messy situation, Fred, but maybe, maybe, just maybe, things are going in the right direction now.
Yeah, one can only hope, and it would be nice to have a little grass on a golf course. I know it makes it a lot easier to play.
Having grass on the golf course, you know, that would certainly please Donald Trump. He's not a big fan of these golf courses that are not green, so it'll certainly please him.
Well, we certainly want to make Donald happy. We wouldn't want to piss him off.
Absolutely not.
Kieran, Vaughn Taylor had a nasty encounter with a water hazard the other day. Professional golfer and former U.S. Ryder Cup team member Vaughn Taylor's boat capsized on Thurman Lake that's located on the Georgia-South Carolina line here in the state, and Taylor was forced to swim to shore. He is an Augusta, Georgia native and was a member of the 2006 Ryder Cup team. He had a scare on the lake last Monday. The Army Corps of Engineers confirmed that Taylor's boat turned over near a powerhouse near a dam. One of the powerhouse operators saw the incident and instructed Vaughn to use his cooler as a flotation device. And then the operator contacted two rangers who assisted Taylor once he reached the shore on the Georgia side of the lake. Taylor is evidently quite the angler. Well, maybe not quite as good as what he thought he was, because he can't stay in the boat. But in the area where he was, I guess the fishing is pretty good. It's a great area to catch fish, but it's not very safe for boaters there. The 48-year-old Taylor lost his PGA Tour playing privileges, has been playing on the web.com tour this season. He played his college golf at Augusta State and has been a professional since 1999. He has played just three events on the PGA Tour this season, making two cuts and earning only $20,000. He is ranked number 43 on the web.com tour, so has a chance to get in the top 25 to earn his playing privileges for the PGA Tour next year. So he did have a little bit of a scare, fell out of his boat, flipped over, and he did make it to shore, so all's well that ends well. Have you ever had a boating incident, Kieran?
Well, I'll tell you a story quickly. I grew up on an island in the west of Scotland, and I went there recently for a little visit, and I was on the ferry going across to the island, and suddenly the alarms on the ferry started going off. And I thought, and I was panicking, thinking, oh, my goodness, we're going to crash into something. And then I looked at the front of the ferry, and we were going directly towards a lighthouse, like rocky edge of the water. So I thought, well, you know, my time had come. This is going to be the end of my life. And but it came to pass that a little yacht had actually crossed in front of the ferry and caused the ferry to, quite a large boat, to have to turn right, to steer right towards the mainland and almost crash into the rock. So I have had some experience of some boating troubles, but nothing quite as dramatic as what happened to Vaughn Taylor.
Well, that sounds quite exciting. I'm glad we didn't lose you so that you could do the show.
Well, I'm glad too.
Well, that wraps up the Par 5 news for this week. And when we come back on the other side of the break, Kieran and I will break down the golf action from the Wegmans LPGA Champion and the Wyndham Championship, as well as the European Tour event. So, Carlos, if you want to take us into our first break of the night, please, sir.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back. And I know I don't say that as well as Carlos does, but I'm just doing my best here, folks. Hey, the Wegmans LPGA Championship was held last weekend up by Rochester, New York. It's one of the oldest tournaments on the LPGA Tour, but it's the last one they're going to have. Brittany Lincecum had her second major title in her grasp and let it slip away on the last hole. She ended up tied with defending champion Envy Park and lost to Park on the first playoff hole. For Park, it was her fifth career major title, her fourth major in the last year, and 11th LPGA Tour victory. Remember, she won three consecutive majors last season to reach the number one spot on the Rolex rankings. This win moves her back behind only Stacey Lewis into the second spot in the Rolex rankings and in the race to the CME Globe. Tough pill for Brittany Lincecum to swallow, but a great tournament for her all the same. Kieran, did you happen to catch any of the Wegmans LPGA Tour there?
Oh, I certainly did, and I enjoyed it immeasurably. And for MB Park, you know, to win that was a tremendous victory for her, and you know, her fifth major championship. Of course, she won three majors last year consecutively, also won in 2008. And some people might say she had a quiet season. You know, only had one win, which was the in Canada back in June, but she's had a fantastic season again with 11 top 10 finishes, so really consistent. And she's the first player to successfully defend the LPGA Championship since Annika Sorenstam's hat-trick a decade ago. And, you know, at Monroe Golf Club, which was really a kind of a big hitter's golf course in theory, and you know, Brittany Lincecum, who's the second longest driver on the LPGA Tour, you know, was leading, so obviously doing so well. So that's an illustration of just how big a golf course it was, and it rewarded the big hitters. But MB Park is not one of the big hitters, but obviously a tremendous putter, one of the best putters in the game, and that, you know, made the difference for her in the end. And you know, for her, it's just, she's a fantastic player and plays with such a wonderful rhythm and does everything so well. You know, she has no real weaknesses to her game. It's just a very steady, consistent game, and it's just how she's able to retain her temperament and, you know, come into the playoff. And she never even stood in the range and hit balls. She just went straight, you know, onto the playoff and won it. So, but for Brittany Lincecum, of course, Fred, you know, devastating to come so close and miss out on her second major championship, of course, the Craft Nabisco winner back in 2009, and incidentally one of only two players in the history of professional golf to actually eagle the last hole to win a major. And but really for Brittany, this week came out of nowhere. She's shown very little form this year, only had one top 10, which was back in May, that was even a tie for 10th, kind of a backdoor top 10, if you like. But for her, you know, obviously a devastating loss, but she has to take the, you know, the heart and positives from this year. A really good week. She's a very gifted player, very powerful player, and really a player who should be, you know, performing a lot better than she is right now. And perhaps this year will really spur her on to have more success in the coming months and the next year. But disappointing for her. And of course, Lydia Ko, finishing third. You know, she'd have been the youngest ever winner of a major championship, and it's a player that continues to just astound us in what she can do, and just her talent, her temperament, everything about her is just so impressive. And, you know, she'll get that major before long, and might come next month at the Evian, we'll wait and see. But, you know, it was very nearly this week, but, you know, unbelievable talent. And even Azahara Muñoz, you know, the Spaniard who was retaining the momentum, of course, from Spain's international crown triumph a few weeks ago. And, you know, she's a fantastic player, and, you know, finished tied for fourth there as well. But there was disappointment, of course, for Suzanne Pettersen, for the great Norwegian, who was right in there in the mix, and she shot 76 on Sunday. Just didn't really get it going at all. Just really struggled from the front nine in particular. I think she ran out in 41. Just a really poor performance. Kind of fought back a little bit in the back nine, but in the end, a very disappointing day for Suzanne. But, you know, she's a tremendous player. Had a few injury problems this year, but, you know, she's going to be a real contender coming up in the next few weeks and potentially at the Evian Championship as well. And, of course, we spoke about consistency. No player is more consistent than Stacey Lewis. You know, incredible, yet another top 10. And Fred, you know, it's her 14th top 10 of the season, which is just ridiculous. It's mind-boggling figures. And that's, you know, she snuck in there, I think, a tie for 7th for Stacey. You know, not a win for her this week, but, you know, she's always in the mix, just making an absolute fortune in terms of money, but and racking up those CMB Globe points as well. And Lexi Thompson, of course, started off brilliantly with a 66, you know, the Craft Nabisco champion this year in the spring. But she had really three lacklustre rounds to follow it and fell right out of things. But Lexi's a tremendous player, and, again, look hard to contend in coming weeks. And for a player who is a great player of the past, you know, Dame Laura Davis, what a week for her. You know, two-time champion of the event, finished in a tie for 25th. Of course, last month she finished in the top 10 at the British Open, so she's rolling back the years as a great dame of golf. And, you know, it was a great event, you know, an interesting golf course, really good crowds in Rochester, a city that's really supported the game of golf so well over the years. And, of course, Fred, the event was on to a new era next year at Westchester, but for the LPGA, I thought it was a tremendous week, great championship.
Yeah, that's one of the key stories coming out of here, of course, is that next year this tournament becomes the Women's PGA Championship that the PGA of America is running in conjunction with the LPGA Tour. The purse will be bumped up from $2.25 million all the way up to $3.5 million, making it one of the bigger purses on the Women's Tour. You know, this win, Karina, also puts Indy Park in the running for the Rolex Annika Award. Points are earned from performances in the five major championships, and the winner must have won at least one of the majors. So right now, Lexi Thompson, who won the Craft Nabisco, Michelle Wee, who won the U.S. Women's Open, and Mo Martin, the Women's British Open winner, and now, of course, Park, the LPGA championship winner, are the ones that are in the running for that. Michelle is currently leading with Indy right behind her. So with just the Evian left to go, that's going to be decided here in a few weeks. You know, Michelle could still win it, but, you know, she's out with that sore hand. So We don't know when she will be back. I'm sure she's going to want to try and play in the Evian. You mentioned the Alejandro Munoz. Boy, every time you turn around, you're talking about a Spanish player this year. Sergio's doing well on the tour and in the world. And you've got the four Spanish ladies, of course, that won the international crown. You mentioned Suzanne had another great week. She's been playing solid for the last couple of weeks. I think it's still just a little bit of rust. She's just not quite back to form yet from being off from her back problem. And Laura Davies is having one of the best years. She's just popping up on leaderboards and just around all the time. So really impressive the year she's having. Any other comments on the LPGA Championship team?
No, I agree with your point there on Suzanne being a little bit rusty. But again, I say she had a few injury problems earlier in the year, and it seems to try and go over that and get more consistent again. Obviously, she played well at the British Open as well. So, again, Suzanne's such a great competitor, you know, a real major player, and I'm sure she'll be right in there again for the Evian next month.
Well, let's move on to the Wyndham Championship. We had somebody pop up there that we haven't heard anything from for a while. Camilo Villegas won for the first time since 2010. He even lost his car for a while, struggled. Just things weren't going well for him. But he has been playing much better of late, especially this year. You've been hearing his name pop up here and there. Ends up shooting 63, 69, 68, and then another 63 on Sunday, finishing at 17 under par, winning by one shot over Bill Haas and Freddie Jacobson. So really have not heard much from him at all, but this is a big win for him, sets him up for a couple of years. Now if he keeps putting the work in, and hopefully things will work out well for him. He was a bright light a few years ago on tour and a very popular player, especially in the Latin American countries. Keith Slocum had a great week, a guy you haven't heard much out of, was hanging down around the 125th spot. Matter of fact, I think he started 158 in the FedEx Cup, missed a putt at the end of his round on Sunday that would have got him into the FedEx Cup. He ends up finishing 129, and so he's off to the Web.com Tour Final. Two players that everybody's watching for Ryder Cup consideration, Brant Snedeker and Webb Simpson, had a really good tournament. They ended up tied with Nick Watney, another guy who's having a renaissance of sorts. They ended up tied for fifth at 14 under par. That's a great golf course, a lot of history there at Sedgefield Country Club in Greensboro. Sam Snead won this tournament so many times over the years, I think eight times. But they had a pretty good tournament. Tough break for Slocum, but a really good win for Camilo Villegas.
Well, absolutely, Fred. And as you say there, Camilo's had a real struggle in the past couple of years, and he's now getting his game back and resurrecting his career almost. Because, of course, as you say, back in 2008, he won two of the playoff events in the FedEx Cup that year and really was kind of the next big thing. We kind of thought he was going to real push on and be a real contender at the top of the game in the majors and so on. Didn't really happen for him. A couple of injury problems, loss of form, as often can happen with confidence after an injury. You come back and you try and nurse the injury and try and almost accommodate it in your game, and eventually it has a real influence on how well you can play. And he lost his card, had to go back to Q School in 2012, didn't actually come through Q School successfully, only had conditional status last year, but he was able to regain his card. He finished 110th on the FedEx Cup last year. He got his card back, been more consistent this year, putting good scores in, and that final round there, 63, just unbelievable front nine. We thought he was going to be in 59 watch there, and 63, just tremendous, and a real boost for him. Opens doors. He's back in the Masters next year, gives him a two-year exemption on the tour, so that you can go and plot your schedule out. No worries about trying to keep your card. Just go out there and continue to try and get your game back to where you want it to be. And, he's only 32 years of age, so there's still many years left in the career of Camilo Villegas. So, maybe the best are yet to come for him. You'll have to wait and see. But as you say there, there's a lot of guys that had a lot to play for there on Sunday. Keith Slocum, of course, trying to keep his card, top 125, keep their card for next year in the FedEx Cup. and he just missed out there. You know, devastating. Bogeying the last two holes, having made an eagle only, I think it was 15th, a par 5, made eagle there, and birdie at 16, then he bogeyed 17 and 18. So a real devastating finish for Heath Slocum. Just missed out on the 1-2-5. We kept his card for next year. As you say, he has to go back to the FedEx Cup next year and try and, the Web.com Tour Finals and try and get his card from there. But for Bill Haas, you know, to come out through there, he's had a very quiet year by his standards, a guy we usually can imagine going to win one event a season. He's one of those very consistent players. Like a Dustin Johnson before his troubles, you know, comes back every year, wins an event, just a very solid player. That's a great finish for him. You know, really boost for his confidence going into the playoffs in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, maybe if he was to maybe come through and perhaps win the Barclays or something, then maybe he would be on Tom Watson's radar in terms of a Ryder Cup pick. But as you said there, Fred, you know, you had Snedeker and Simpson, who really are two of the guys that are right in that mix for a Ryder Cup pick from Tom Watson, which is only a couple of weeks away now. I think it's the 2nd of September Watson makes his wild card picks. And those two guys there played together on Sunday, I think, and they played fantastically, really good finishes. And that's a massive boost for those players, and also for Tom Watson. Really, you know, see all the problems he's had with players being injured. You know, Duffner, Kuchar, Dustin Johnson disappearing, Tiger Woods, and even Steve Stricker, his vice captain, who he was kind of considering putting on his potentially being a pick, depending on form. Steve Stricker has pulled out the Barclays in the rest of the year, really, with injury. So there's another one for you. And Nick Watney, I go back to the players who had a lot to play for and were kind of struggling there towards the end with the pressure of the situation. Nick Watney, you know, closing double bogey, hit his tee shot out of bounds. You know, 18th played very difficult all day, was the hardest hole in the course. But Nick Watney, a closing six. He, as you say, Fred, a renaissance a few weeks for him. He's playing a lot better again. Played well at the Barracuda Championship, the Stableford event, and he played well at the PGA Championship. And he's, you know, another good friend there. A very talented player. A guy 3-4 years ago we kind of thought was going to be one of the top 10 American players. Hasn't worked out for him, but there's still time. And Freddie Jacobson, a European who now is officially Freddie Jacobson, of course. He changed his name. And again, a bogey in the last for him. He free-putted the last hole, I think. And you know, it's a guy who is so renowned for his putting. One of the best putters in the game. And he free-putted the last. Admittedly, he gave himself a long first putt, but still, he's a bit better from him. And again, that's a pressure situation. We saw really a lot of guys here who are either coming back to form or had a lot to play for in terms of their careers, like Heath Slocum did. And in that situation, the pressure is intensified, and we see players make these really top players making mistakes like free-putting or hitting T-shirts out of bounds. You know, the pressure can get to anybody, particularly in that situation. For Camilo Villegas, you know, a fantastic front nine. He was steady in the back nine, held it together, got a bit of luck with the guys falling apart behind them. But, you know, Villegas is back, and it's good to see. One of the hardest working players in the game, and I used to say a very popular player as well.
You know, one of the other sidelights of the Wyndham Championship, it's the last regular season tour event, and so the race to get in the top 125, to get into the FedEx Cup playoffs, ends that the last week, and we had one player that played his way in, Sangmun Bai, who started out at the 126, ends up shooting his way in, having a very good tournament, ends up number 120. So he gets into the playoffs. The James Hahn, Bryce Mulder, Louis Oosthuizen, Morgan Hoffman, and Robert Allenby ends up being number 125 for 2014. Guys that just missed, Nicholas Thompson, Martin Laird, J.J. Henry, we mentioned Heath Slocum, and Charlie Beljon. So those guys are just out, so they're going to be heading to the Web.com Tour Finals that will start here in a couple of weeks to try and earn one of the 25 cards that are available from that series to be back on tour next year, at least to get into some tournaments. So that pretty much wraps up the Wyndham Championship on the PGA Tour. There was a pretty good tournament on the European Tour that you made in Denmark. You want to tell us a little bit about that, Kieran?
Yeah, absolutely, Fred. The first European Tour event held in Denmark in 11 years, and they had massive crowds all week, over 80,000 people during the tournament, almost 25,000 that were there on Sunday. Huge crowds on a golf course that was really buffeted by winds. On Saturday, they had 30-mile-per-hour gusts. Conditions were incredibly difficult. And really, you have to have a player who has complete control of his golf swing and his temperament to really do well in those conditions. And that guy this week was Mark Warren, who won his third European Tour title, his first since winning the Johnny Walker Championship at Glen Eagles back in 2007. And the Scot has been in fantastic form in the last month. He qualified for the Open Championship, then he finished tied fourth at the Scottish Open, played well at the Open, and he finished tied 15th last week at the PGA Championship at Valhalla. But Mark Warren, he had a brilliant weekend. He shot rounds of 66 in those incredible, difficult conditions on Saturday. 66 on Saturday, 68 on Sunday to win by two shots from Bradley Dredge, the Welshman who he shared lead with going into the final round. And Warren was the only player to shoot both rounds, Saturday and Sunday, in the 60s in the field. And that was an illustration of just how good he was. It was a magnificent performance from a player who has a lot of talent. He has a lot of, he's had near misses in the recent times. He had a near loss at Wentworth last year and the Scottish Open a couple of years back. So a long time coming, Fred, and it's good to see him back in the winner's circle. A guy who, again, has a lot of talent. He worked with Bob Torrance, the legendary coach who recently passed away during the Open Championship week, and a guy who's kind of criticised for perhaps his work ethic, didn't work perhaps hard enough when he was younger, more interested in enjoying himself, buying flash cars and new apartments and stuff like that. But he's older now, he's more experienced, he's more settled in his game, and he's got a fantastic golf swing, one of the best in the European Tour, and a player who really now, with this win behind him, could really push on and become one of the top players on the European Tour. And for Bradley Dredge, Fred, you know, a guy who really has had a terrible few years of injury and form problems. He was way down the race to Dubai, not even, you know, he has done nothing all year, and he comes here and he finishes second, and that is going to keep his card for next year. And that's a fantastic week for Bradley Dredge, one of the guys, he's won twice in the European Tour, had success about 5 or 6 years ago. He's back in the in contending in events again, and that's a good sign for him going into the future. He can now plan his schedule for next season. It's a massive relief to these guys, of course. And, you know, Philip Archer, another guy who we haven't heard much of. He played in the European Tour for a number of years, about half a decade ago. Since he's been really playing predominantly on the Challenge Tour, but he played this week, and he finished in third in his own. It will not give him a European Tour card for next year, but it will give him a huge boost, of course, going into the final weeks of the Challenge Tour season, which are coming up. And, of course, it was in Denmark, and the big crowds, they were all behind Thomas Bjorn, the home favourite. And, Fred, I don't know whether you saw this or not, but on the 16th hole on Sunday, where huge crowds were around the back of the green, and Thomas Bjorn, perhaps one of the last guys you'd ever imagine would do this, he took a selfie with his phone, with the crowd behind him, with his two playing partners. Unbelievable stuff. And of course, Fred, you know, Thomas Bjorn has that quite remarkable beard. I don't know what's going on there. It's one of the it's actually one of the wonders of the world, I think, now. And you really don't know what's growing in there. There's probably dead animals in there. You know, there's probably Dustin Johnson's probably in there. No, we don't know where he is, but he's probably in Thomas Bjorn's beard now. It's an incredible, you know, thing. But he finished tied fourth, so a good week for him. Secures his Ryder Cup spot for Glen Eagles, so, you know, and also showing good form, which will impress Captain McGinley. And another Dane was Thorbjørn Olesen, who did well at the PGA Championship last week. He came over to Denmark in his home event, and he, again, tied for seventh there. A really good, solid week. Had the fans behind him all the way. A player who had a lot of potential. People remember him playing with Tiger a couple of years ago in the Open at Lyvham. And he actually beat Tiger, I think, that day, and he was fantastic. A real talent, hasn't quite happened consistently for him, but maybe this is a sign of things to come. But I say, Fred, you know, a great event, 80,000 fans during the week. I cannot believe the tour has not been there for 11 years. It was surely to be back here on a more regular basis, as the fans there loved the game. You know, the great atmosphere, kind of Ryder Cup type atmosphere, despite the difficult weather conditions. For Mark Warren, a win that is long overdue, but a fantastic performance, 66, 68 in the weekend, in some of the hardest conditions you'll see on any tour, and he can be very proud of himself for getting that victory.
Yeah, they obviously were golf stars there in Denmark, and they did turn out, and they got to see a pretty good event, even though there wasn't a lot of big names there. Of course, Bjorn was probably the biggest name, and he definitely had the biggest beard. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the Champions Tour. They had a tournament there this week, the Dick's Sporting Goods Open, and, you know, that's the old BC Open. It used to be played opposite the Open Championship for a long time. It was kind of a second field event, but something quite remarkable happened there on Saturday. Kevin Sutherland, who was a journeyman golfer for a long time, I think he started his career, he played a lot in Europe on the European Tour. He would bounce over towards the end of his career. He ended up making some money on the PGA Tour and stuck around there, actually playing pretty well. But he posted the very first 59 in Champions Tour history, and this was not on a par 70 golf course here, and this was a real golf course, a par 72. He was 13 under par, and Kieran, he bogeyed the last hole for a 59. He was looking at a 58 right in the face, missed a he came up a little short on his first putt and missed his second, but he started out, I don't know if you looked at his card or not, but he started out birdie, 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 eagle, birdie, birdie, birdie. He was 9 under after 8 holes. You know, the other players, they were talking to John Cook. They said, well, what did you think when you, he said, about the scores when you saw that? And he said, well, he said, I looked up and I saw that Kevin was 9 under after 8 holes. That's pretty crazy. He said, he said, it was Saturday. I said, if it was Sunday, I'd have worried about it, but we still had another day, so I just had to go out and perform. Then Sutherland started the back nine, birdie, birdie, so he's 11 under after 11 holes, Kieran, and he made 3 pars in a row. I don't know what the hell happened there. You know, that making 3 pars, or he must have felt like he was making double bogeys. And then he made the 3 birdies on 15, 16, and 17 to get to 14 under. Would have been 58 on a par 72. That's like perfect stuff. Ends up bogeying 18, has to settle for the 59. You know, he didn't play that well on Sunday, shoots a 74, ends up falling down the leaderboard. But what a tournament for him. And, I failed to mention that you know, guess what? Who won, Kieran? Bernhard Langer won again. This is only Bernhard's 5th win this year. It's his 4th. He's had 5 wins, 4 runner-ups, 2 third-place finishes, 15 top 10s, 16 top 25, and he's only started 16 events, Kieran. He's up to $2.6 million. Making a mockery of the Charles Schwab Cup, and the rumors are bouncing around that McGinley's going to have to pick him for the Ryder Cup. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think Langer's going to win the Ryder Cup team, I can tell you that right now. I think there's a difference between being able to go out there and play great golf against senior players and senior golf courses when, in the end, and playing golf in the highest level in the European or PGA Tours. I'm not sure Langer's ever going to be considered for a pick for the Ryder Cup team. I'm sure you do fine, I'm sure you perform very well, but it's not going to happen. However, again, as you say, Fred, you know, his stats are incredible. The consistency in his game, he's having almost, for a guy that's won 2 Masters, I mean, world number one, won, you know, 40 times in the European Tour, he's almost having a career season. The way he's playing, the quality of his game is unbelievable. And, you know, the 4 rounds he played at Royal Porthcawl Senior Open Championship last month were among, that was one of the best 72-hole performances you'll ever see on that burnt golf course. And he's carried that form into this week as well. And the way he played, you know, it's just, it is quite remarkable. And I say, I'm sure you'd perform fine on the Ryder Cup team, but I think McGinley has so many options of players who are younger, play regularly on the big tours, and in the end, that's going to count for more. But Langer is unbelievable. And he had his daughter on the bag this week, Christina, and she is a golfer herself. They actually play together at the Masters, and the Sunday before the tournament starts at Augusta, past champions can bring a guest onto the golf course with them, and those two play golf together at Augusta National. That's the ultimate sort of father-daughter time, I guess you can say. And, you know, great time for her to see her dad win an event with her in the bag. That's his 23rd Champions Tour victory, Fred, and his 5th this season, of course. But he's still, unbelievably, 22 behind Hale Irwin. And I'm not sure Hale Irwin's record is ever going to be beaten, but, you know, if Bernhard Langer can go at this rate and play for another 10, 15 years, you know, you never know. But he's certainly going up that all-time list anyway. But, again, Langer is just playing some of the highest quality golf in any tour this season. It's special to watch. And Woody Austin, you know, finished second, and a newly turned 50-year-old. He won on the PGA Tour last year, won the event that goes along with the Open Championship, the co-sanctioned event, and he won there. And, you know, Woody Austin, he's a guy, he's an interesting character, let's put it that way. I've never been quite sure what to make of Woody Austin. He's either an absolute genius or a complete idiot. I'm not quite sure which, I've never quite been sure which it is. Some of his comments are quite interesting, but he's either a genius or a complete idiot. I'm not sure. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, though. And Marco Mira, you know, excellent week for him. A guy who's suffering with tendonitis in his elbow in recent weeks. He missed the Open Championship and the Senior Open. Of course, he won the Open back in 98 at Birkdale. He missed that week because of his tendonitis. He's coming back here playing well. Good signs for him. But, of course, Kevin Sutherland, that's going to be the headlines. Going out there and shooting 59, you know, had he birdied the last hole, Fred, so a 57 would have been the lowest recorded score in the history of professional golf. Ryo Ishikawa shot 58 in Japan a few years ago, but no one has ever shot 57. You know, but he put his tee shot in the trees, and they struggled from there, made bogey, of course, in the end. But, you know, it's unbelievable. But in saying that, Fred, you know, Kevin Sutherland made three pars in 18 holes. And to be honest with you, I do that every single time I go out and play. It's not that impressive. Unfortunately, the other 15 holes aren't quite as impressive for me. But yeah, you're 59-74. That's a big contrast in rounds, although not the biggest that I have discovered. At the Masters in 1990, Mike Donald shot 64 on the first day, and then he shot 82 on the second day. So it's 18 shots difference. And the 2002 Open Championship at Muirfield, and he'll hate me for mentioning this. He'll never let me stalk him again around Perth, but Colin Montgomery. And the Open in 2002 at Muirfield, he shot 64 on day two, and on day three, Fred, he shot 84. 20 shots worse. So big contrasts are possible. They do happen. But if you shot a 59 the first day, I guess it makes it taste a bit sweeter. But for Bernard Langer, you know, golf is the easiest thing in the world to him right now. It's probably easier than breathing, sleeping, eating. Golf is just, like, he's unbelievable at it right now. But, you know, obviously great storylines. Bernard Langer, Kevin Sutherland, you know, great event. And, you know, really a story there, Kevin Sutherland, he'll remember that forever.
Yeah, that's going to be the big story coming out of there for sure. Hey, web.com had a tournament, the Sentinel Pilot, and Martin Piller won that. He shot 22 under, 65, 67, 67, 63. That's some pretty good scoring right there. Bronson Burgoon took second place at 20 under. Darren Stiles, Ryan Moore for Vaughn Taylor, the fisherman, ends up fifth, so he collects a top 10, moves up to 43 in the top 25. You've got Jason Gore. We talked about him before. He ends up with a top 10. He's up to number 17. So with just one event left before the end of the web.com to a regular season and the start of the finals, looks like he's in good shape for keeping his card. I think there was a couple more events that you had in Europe. You want to talk about those a little bit, Karen?
Yeah, absolutely. And I must quickly say, Fred, about the Web.com Tour event. And my favorite player, of course, in the game of golf is Sebastian Kaplan. Not many people know much about him. In fact, no one knows anything about him. Apart from the fact he's Danish, and he won on the Web.com Tour this year. He still has no photograph on the PGA Tour website, and he missed a cut this week. So I'm disappointed about that. But on to the Scottish Senior Open, which is at Fairmont Club, Fairmont Course in St Andrews, just outside the home of golf. And it's Mark Davis, the Englishman, who only turned 50 last month. He's one of the youngest winners in the Senior Tour history. And he won only his third start on the Senior Tour with a truly brilliant performance. He won by 5 shots in some really blustery, windy conditions and a really tough course and stuff like that. And he shot a final round of 71, 1 under par, when he was only one other player in the whole field shot under par on Sunday. So a tremendous victory for him. And a player who has had a real struggle in his career. He's a twice winner on a European Tour back in the day, but he hasn't played a full schedule on the European Tour since 2002. He's had 12 years really out of the game due to a very serious wrist problem. So to come back from that and to win on the Senior Tour so early on is an unbelievable thing for him. You know, it's a massive boost for his confidence and his belief. And, you know, sets him up well for a really good, you know, career in the Senior Tour. And, you know, he sort of ticked along in the last few years trying to make a living, doing what, you know, various teaching and trying to, you know, just make a living for himself. And now he's here, a professional golfer again, and he's won an event. It's a fantastic story and a brilliant performance. You know, he shot 66 on Friday when the weather was quite calm, so the low scores were certainly there. You know, Cesar, what's his name again? Cesar Monasterio. Monasterio is his name. Cesar. Let's call him Cesar from now on. His second name is too hard to pronounce. But Cesar from Argentina, he shot 61 on Friday. That was the low record score in the European Senior Tour. But he fell back of there from that with 66-79. But he was still the leader going into the last round despite that. But for Mark Davis, brilliant performance from him. He finished ahead of DJ Russell, Englishman who is based in Scotland now, actually a really good course architect. He's actually redesigning right now. He's redesigning the Macrae on the Isle of Islay, which is in Scotland, which is one of the most historic golf courses in the world. One I recommend you check out on the internet. It's spectacular. He's doing the redesign there. It's going to be tremendous. And Philip Golding, a former European Tour player and a regular contender on the Senior Tour, also finished second as well, as did Pedro Linhart, the Spaniard. He shot 76 on Sunday. But for Mark Davis, a fantastic victory on a course designed by Sam Torrance, a European Ryder Cup star who will be the Ryder Cup vice-captain this year for Paul McGinley. He's playing his first event since the passing of his father last month, Bob, and Sam finished in the tie for 29th. So a very credible week for Sam. But for Mark Davis, a very popular figure and delight for him. A five-shot victory, the only player under par after three rounds. And on the golf course, it was so windy, there were 20-mile-per-hour gusts on Sunday, a tough golf course in those conditions, and he made it look easy. Fantastic performance. And Fred, on the Challenge Tour, there was an event as well, and two guys who have been on the European Tour before have contended there. They were top two there. You know, Mark Tulo, the Chilean, who represented Chile twice in the World Cup. This is in Finland. It's kind of Scandinavian feel, much like Denmark for the European Tour. And Mark Tulo shot a final round of 64 to win by three shots ahead of Sweden's Pelle Edberg, who wears a ridiculous headband. He's in the European Tour for a number of years. He's kind of fallen away in recent years. For those two guys, nearly, he finished three ahead of him. Edberg was at 17 under. Tulo was at 20 under. So for them, Tulo won his fourth Challenge Tour victory. He now goes up to ninth on the Challenge Tour order of merit, the top 15 at the end of the season, qualify for the European Tour next season. It's quite a strict thing for the European Tour. Only the top 15 in the Challenge Tour, which is very competitive, of course, only the top 15 guys there get onto the European Tour. And Mark Tulo now is now right in the mix to be one of those guys to book their ticket to the European Tour next year. He's played there before, and he's had success there before as well. He's finished second a couple of times. And Pelle Edberg, of course, I say he's played the European Tour for 7 or 8 years around kind of the mid-2000s, he's up to 37th in the order of merit on the Challenge Tour. He's a lot of work to do in the next few events. And there are 8 events remaining in the Challenge Tour, Fred, until the grand final at the end of the season. So only top 15 guys get through, only 8 events left, and it's going to be very competitive. A lot of changes are going to happen. There's still a lot to play for there. The Web.com Tour, as you said, is finished the regular season there, but on the Challenge Tour, there's still a lot for these guys to play for. But for Mark Tulo, massive boost for him, and of course in the Senior Tour, Mark Davis, what a victory. Scottish Senior Open Champion 2014, fantastic.
Well, that wraps up our recaps from last week's action, and we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit the pros and cons of the FedEx Cup and preview the PGA Tour's first FedEx Cup event, the Barclays. Call us if you would take us in the break, please.
Thank you for listening to the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
Feel like a little bit of an underdog. That might be pretty fitting, going against the powerhouse Kieran Clark there. I'm going to talk about a little bit about the FedEx Cup here for a second, then we're going to turn it over to Kieran, and he's going to tear me apart. But Kieran, you know, the FedEx Cup, of course, was the brainchild of Tim Finchem and his staff. They looked for something that would garner golf fans' attention and the casual golf fan also that maybe wanted to switch over and watch the baseball, the last month of baseball, the football starting, high school football, college football, professional football starting, which seems to dominate the airwaves this time of year. So they came up with the idea of a playoff system. FedEx pumped a bunch of money into it. Baseball has a playoff. Basketball has a playoff. Football has playoffs. Even hockey has playoffs. So I guess why can't golf? And they came up with this program of having
the playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. You kidding me? Playoffs?
It is time to talk about them now because we are in them. We are there. The first playoff event will be held this week. The first FedEx Cup playoff event will be the Barclays at Paramus, New Jersey, right outside of New York City, across the river. Each one of these four events have an $8 million purse. So that's $32 million available for the players over the next 4 weeks to play for. Each winner's check of these four events will be $1.44 million. And then there's the additional $35 million of bonus pool money that FedEx puts in. That's split among the top players, with the top prize being the $10 million that goes to the winner of the FedEx Cup. And, of course, only the top 125 get in. After the first week a cut is made down to 100, then they cut down to 70, and then there's only 30 that make it to the final FedEx Cup playoff event, the Tour Championship, which is held at Eastlake in Atlanta, Georgia. So there's over the next 4 weeks, Kieran, there's $67 million that's going to be split up among about 150 players, basically, but really the top 125 are going to split this money up. So it does capture sports media attention. You see it talked about on television, on ESPN, not only the Golf Channel, but, different sports shows talk about who's in the playoffs, who's out of the playoffs, who could win, who's hot. We've got Rory, we got Adam Scott, we got Tiger's not playing this year, and of course Dustin Johnson, those guys are out, but Matt Kuchar is right there, and some of the other guys that could jump up and pick some of these up. We've also, through these first couple of playoff events, Kieran, we've got to watch for who's going to jump up and play well and play their way onto Tom Watson's U.S. Ryder Cup team. You've also got some guys that still have some hope of trying to get on to Paul McGinley's European Ryder Cup team. So there's still a lot to play for. There's a tremendous amount of money that's going to be split up. And the biggest thing from this, Kieran, is that prior to the FedEx Cup playoff, these last events after the PGA Championship, just not, very little notice, very poorly attended. TV didn't even cover them sometimes. I mean, it was pretty chaotic. And then you had those silly season events that started way early, and now, thank goodness, those have got compressed all into the month of December. So we do have a natural progression now. We come from the regular season into the playoffs, then either into the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup, and now we go right into the wraparound fall season with the six events that will start kickoff for 2015. So the FedEx Cup has some merit. It brings some order to the tour. It does kind of put an end to the tour. There's one thing that I don't like about it, but I'll save that until you're done ranting and raving, because I know that you just love these FedEx Cup playoffs so much. So that's kind of my piece on it, and I'll turn it over to you. I'll shut up for a minute and turn it over to you.
Well, I do agree with the point you make there, Fred, about the fact that it has extended the season. It has given us worthwhile golf, really, in the PGA Tour in August, in September. And obviously, as you say, the PGA Tour season essentially shut down after the PGA Championship before 2007. That's changed now. We have four great fields and over the next 4 weeks, and that is fantastic. I would never dispute that. However, the actual concept of the FedEx Cup, the actual system, the way it's implemented, is truly ridiculous. and it's very hard to take seriously, and I'm not sure anyone actually does. You know, no one ever says, oh, wow, Rory McIlroy won the Open Championship. Just think of those 600 FedEx Cup points that go with it. No, and if they do say that, Fred, they're being ironic. I'm not sure anyone truly cares. I've been reading Twitter the last couple of days. I haven't seen any regular person on my Twitter even mention the FedEx Cup playoffs. I don't think anyone truly cares. They may care about the event and say, well, it's a great field. All the top players are there that are available. That's good to watch. But I'm not so sure the actual system, the actual race, if you like, the FedEx Cup, is particularly compelling at all, and I'll explain to you why. I think golf fans are a little bit different from other sports fans, generally speaking. The FedEx Cup system was initially based, I believe, on NASCAR, so motor racing. And nothing against motor racing, but I think it's hard to compare the two. So the system we have here, you know, players in a regular event, you win the PGA, you win a PGA Tour event, a regular one, you get 500 FedEx Cup points. And when you come to the four playoff events, the point system changes. It's suddenly increased dramatically, where a winner of the Barclays this week gets 2,500 FedEx Cup points, you know, and a ridiculous increase. So really, if you win a major championship, Fred, you get 600 points. And to get the player that finishes 10th this week at the Barclays will also get 600 points. So it is incredibly weighted towards the four playoff events, which is a little bit, it's okay having a little bit, you know, create a little bit of volatility, if you like, and try and mix things up a little bit. But there is to an extent where guys who have done nothing all season, really, can suddenly surge right through the whole thing in a matter of 1 week. You know, anyone who finishes in the top five is going to surge from wherever they are on the list into contention to win the whole thing. And that seems a bit stupid. And because they try and coin it as being, they try and plug it as being, oh, the reward for the, it's a season-long championship, season-long thing, contest where the best player is going to win it. That doesn't happen. It's not necessarily the case. If it does happen, it's by chance more than anything else. And it doesn't even reward the best player in the playoffs. And I'll explain why. As they have when they go into the Tour Championship, the final event of the playoffs, they have a points reset. So no matter what player number one has points-wise, he could have 1,000,000 points, but his points get set to 2,500 again. So every player, the top 30 players in the Tour Championship, all have a chance to win the overall $10 million prize at the end of the whole thing. So to me, that seems ridiculous. And this is here's how daft it sounds. A player could win every single event on the PGA Tour, win all four major championships, win all three of the first playoff events, finish second in the Tour Championship, and still not win the FedEx Cup. Now, obviously, that's never going to happen, but a system that has such a fallacy and such a flaw cannot be taken seriously. Any excitement that comes from this is manufactured. It's arbitrary. It's just nonsense. And we saw 3 years ago when Bill Haas won the whole thing. Yeah, that was ridiculous. You know, he came in there 25th. In the FedEx Cup going into the last event, and somehow he won the whole thing in that playoff, and he didn't even realize he was playing for the $10 million. He thought he was playing to win the Tour Championship. He didn't even know that the money was on the line. It made for good television. He played the unbelievable shot from the water. However, he didn't even know, and that just sums up how stupid it is. Even the players don't understand the arithmetic to it. And you know, how are we as golf fans supposed to look at has no credibility. A major championship has credibility because it has got the history, it has got the procedure of winning a major. You're the best player that week, won it, that's it, that's settled, that's fine. But the FedEx Cup doesn't have that because, for a start, it's flawed. The point system's over the top. It's far too weighted towards the playoffs, and the points reset just makes a mockery of the whole thing. Yes, well, occasionally in the past, players in the first 2 years fully brought in the points reset, did win the FedEx Cup before the final event was even played. However, that may not be particularly compelling for viewing as such. However, it makes the thing more credible. I think credibility is the most important thing for any competition you're trying to introduce. And think about the prize. So the competition isn't that compelling because of its format and its concept. So, well, the prize. Is the prize compelling? Well, lots of money. Oh, money is wonderful. It's a bit like golf. I refer to the FedEx Cup as being golf's version of a game show. You know, you win one stage, then they tell you you've got to do something else to win the next, get through to the next stage, then the next stage. It seems a bit rehearsed, a bit manufactured. And the prize itself, you know, $10 million to the leading player, that's wonderful. But what's so compelling about that? These guys are all multimillionaires. They have millions of dollars in the bank. They are set for life. They could buy me, they could sell me, they could buy my house for with a drop of their wallet, you know. But it's simply rich guys getting richer. Now, that's all it is. Do we care about that? Is that interesting? No, not really. If you have a game show where the winner, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the guy wins $1 million for answering 15 questions or whatever it was, you know, that's compelling because he's a regular guy. You know, when they have a celebrity game show, the celebrities don't receive the prize. They donate it to charity. So that's a case of rich guys not getting richer, but in the PGA Tour, in a kind of game show format, which a FedEx Cup really is, then rich guys do actually get richer. It's gross indulgence of money. You mentioned there was $67 million. It's almost offensive, that much money. You know, in this day and age, or the state the world is in, it's hard to swallow the money in that. And but again, I don't think anyone truly cares. I think they enjoy it. They'll watch the tournament because you have Rory McIlroy, Adam Scott, these guys all playing, and Phil Mickelson. They'll watch to watch these guys. They will not watch to follow the FedEx Cup. I don't believe anyone out with the PGA Tour headquarters genuinely cares about the FedEx Cup. You know, Tim Finchin tries to big it up as being somehow something very special. He's great at putting a gloss on something. He's great at promoting things. And we had that quote, that little video from Jack Nicklaus early in the season where he said the FedEx Cup was one of the greatest things in golf now. You know, what a lot of rubbish. You know, it's not. Finchin probably had a shotgun to Jack's head when he said that, because he doesn't believe that. There's no way you'd believe that, because something that's so it's so flawed in its setup cannot be taken seriously. Yes, it's big money. Yes, occasionally, if it works out where the best guy's going to win, then it works out okay. But we saw Bill Haas. He was not anywhere near one of the best players in the PGA Tour in 2011. He won the whole thing. It made a mockery of the system. Rory McIlroy won two playoff events in 2012. He won the PGA Championship, and he still didn't win the FedEx Cup. You know, it makes a mockery of the whole system. I can't take it seriously. I'm not even sure that golf fans can take it seriously, and even the players. You know, yes, it's big money. They want to be able to try and win that. But in the end, if the thing's so manufactured, so contrived, can they take it seriously? I'm not sure. But yes, I'll concede the FedEx Cup did extend the season. It has given us four events with really good fields. That is to be praised. That is to be welcomed. However, the actual concept, the actual contest, the FedEx Cup, is not compelling in any way, shape, or form. And I'm now going to have a lie down.
Well, you know, a couple points. The rich getting richer. I mean, you can say that every week, Gary. And, the PGA Championship and the Players this year were both $10 million purses. So you know the U.S. Open and the Masters are going to bump up their purses. You know, the purses they're playing for today are so much bigger than what even Jack Nicklaus played for in the 70s. It's just, you know, his best year he won what, $350,000 or something, and now the top guys win $5, $6, $7, $8, $10 million a year, and then they're playing for the $10 million FedEx Cup. So, you know, the rich getting richer, that's just a sign of the time. The corporations are willing to put the money in for those guys to play for, to get that advertising, to get that exposure. And so that's just a fact. The fact that the FedEx Cup playoffs were developed to really get Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson playing more tournaments later in the season. And they have done that if they're healthy. My problem is that we have extended the season and compacted it so much, really from just after the U.S. Open at the middle of June until now at the end of August, beginning of September, there's all these gigantic events, and these guys have to play so much that it's just too hard on their body. And especially as the guys get older, like Tiger and like Phil, you have to be really fit. Well, okay, it's an athletic sport, so the younger, faster, stronger should win. So the guys like Rory and Ricky and Adam, and, you know, they're younger, they're in better condition, maybe they should be winning this thing like they are. We saw Henrik Stenson get hot last year,
win two of the events and take home the race to Dubai as well as the FedEx Cup. This is working so well that the European Tour has gone to it with their race to Dubai, and that's been very successful for them. So on the whole, Karen, I really think this has been successful. I don't like the length of season, how everything gets so compacted and pressed together in these last two and a half months. I do like the fact that we get to see Tiger and Phil and some of these guys playing when they're healthy in a big tournament, and I love the field. The top 125 playing this first week, then you've got, I mean, all the big guys are there. Last year was big news. I don't think Rory made the final 30 at Eastlake, and that was unusual. But, I mean, that's news. That's what you're looking for. That's what you want to see. That gives us something to talk about. So if media is talking about it, if we're talking about it as golf fans, then that's keeping golf, in the forefront and up for people to watch. So that's kind of my take on it. I'm not a huge FedEx Cup fan. I have to agree with you that $67 million bottles the mind a little bit. But the $32 million over these 4 weeks is big stuff. The other $35 million, you could say, well, they really earn that through the year by getting into the top 150 or top 125 to get a piece of it. And then they just get a bigger piece depending on how well they do over the next 4 weeks. So, the rich get richer, yeah, but that's just the state of the game right now in golf and in professional golf in the United States. So on the whole, I think it's been successful. I think the PGA Tour is to be commended for it. Doesn't still have problems, even though this is the eighth year for it or whatever. Yeah, it still does. They still don't have the points thing figured out right. Luke Donald should have won that. Bill Hodge should not have won that. Luke Donald had the better year by far, and Bill Hodge should not have snuck up with that one shot and won that thing. But that's what gets people's attention. That's what makes the news. That's what makes the sports news on ESPN and all the other channels. So that's kind of my take on it, Kieran. Any final thoughts on that?
Well, I think you've essentially made my point in the sense that, yes, I agree with you. It's fantastic to have the big players playing these 4 weeks. Again, you have your Tigers, your Phils, your Rorys on a normal basis. They'll be playing. That's fantastic. Top 125 players in the PGA Tour. Tremendous. However, one thing you never mentioned during your comments there was the actual FedEx Cup series. The events may be good themselves, may be fantastic to watch individually, but does anyone truly care about who actually wins the FedEx Cup? I don't genuinely believe that they do, and I'm not sure that's ever going to change. Firstly, because I'm not so sure money actually catches people's imagination very much. People like to see players win big trophies, not money. I don't think that really matters. And as I say, it does not even reward the best player during the season or the best player in the playoffs necessarily. So it has no credibility on a sporting level. And in the end, we are sports fans. We watch it for the sporting credibility. It doesn't have that. And it's a good gimmick. It has created these four fantastic events and given us these fantastic fields. However, as a concept, as a competition, it is inherently flawed. And I just don't see anyone paying any real attention to actually wins the overall FedEx Cup. It's not going to matter on anyone's imagination, I don't think.
Well, Kieran, since I have the gavel, I declare myself the winner of this debate, and we're going to move on. We've been talking about it, but this is the PGA Tour's Southern FedEx Cup.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
I am serious.
I want a public vote.
No, this is not a democracy. This is a totalitarian state. They're going to play at the Ridgewood Country Club this year, which is right outside of New York City. It hosted an event in 2008 and 2010. It's a Tillinghast design. It has also hosted the 1935 Ryder Cup, the 74 U.S. Amateur, and the 1990 Senior Open, and the 2001 PGA.
so. This club was founded in 1890. It's one of the oldest clubs in America. Has a rich and storied history. Just a great venue for this tournament. And as we mentioned, the top 125 are in the field. All the big guys are there, and they're going to be trying to make sure that they stay inside the top 100 for the next tournament. So, do you have any comments about the Barclays before we go to break?
Yeah, I do. Quick comments. And I just say, Fred, Ridgewood Country Club is one of the most historic clubs in America. The golf course is 27 holes, 3 9-hole courses. The course they use for the tournament is a composite of the more difficult holes on those 3 9-hole courses, designed by Albert Warren Tillinghast, who is really one of the great prolific course designers back in the early 20th century, one of the kind of the forefathers of American golf, and great history to that. And actually, here's a bit of a little-known fact, that Byron Nelson was actually the assistant professional at Ridgewood back in the 1930s, before he went on to have a great career as a touring professional. He was there as an assistant pro in his younger days. I didn't know that until I read it yesterday. And but yes, you know, we had a great event here before. Matt Kuchar won here in 2010, as did Vijay Singh 2 years earlier. Tom Watson won the senior PGA there 13 years ago. And the 1935 Ryder Cup was at Ridgewood as well. So, again, a great history to the golf course. And Jordan Spieth, how will the course play this year? It's fairly typical sort of American-style golf course, very narrow fairways, tree-lined, bunkers and greens. It sets up very normal, very one-dimensional in that sense. But Jordan Spieth reported on Twitter the other day that the rough may be the hardest on tour this year. So really thick rough is to be expected. He did say birdies could still be made from the fairway, but if players are missing the fairway, doesn't seem like they're going to have much chance to get the ball anywhere near the green. So people who love to watch hacking, one-dimensional golf will be absolutely thrilled by this. I'm not one of those people, so I'm not quite so sure it's going to be a thrilling spectacle. But as you say, Fred, a fantastic field, the top 125 in the PGA Tour FedEx Cup Series. And the pairings, they do the pairings, of course, according to the standings in the FedEx Cup. So you have Rory McIlroy alongside Jimmy Walker, the leader in the FedEx Cup, and Bubba Watson, a great free ball there. And you have Martin Kaymer, Adam Scott, and Ricky Fowler. Those are really the two kind of the marquee pairings, the groupings, and the for Thursday and Friday. So that's going to be fantastic to see. And I said in the little speech before about the FedEx Cup, you know, yes, I don't like the concept. However, it does give us these great events, great fields, and that's to be, again, I'll be watching for the field and not the concept, not the tournament, not the actual contest. But the Barclays, an event, had a go back to 1967, that kind of originated there. And again, Ridgewood, a great historic golf club. It should be a good watch. Again, fantastic field. One of these guys here, from 100 to 125, they need to make a move, of course, to get into the top 100 to get through to next week. But of course, if they come through and finish top five, and suddenly they are in contention to win the whole thing. So things change very quickly. Too quickly for my liking, but it's just how it is. If people enjoy that, that's fine. But the Barclays, it should be good.
Yeah, this whole thing, wouldn't it be cool if we could see Adam Scott, Ricky Fowler, Rory McIlroy, and Jordan Spieth down at the end of about two or three of these tournaments vying for the wins and vying for the $10 million FedEx Cup. That would definitely add some add to the credibility of this thing and really give it some media spikes. Well, Trian, that wraps that up. Let's move on. Let's take one of our next breaks. And when we come back, we're going to hear the part two of the interview I did with Tom Doak a few weeks ago. So, Trian, if you'd take us in, Carlos, if you'd take us in the break, please.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and we have the second part of the interview that I did with Tom Doak a few weeks ago. As you recall, A couple of weeks ago, we played the first part of that, and he talked about his early years, his college years, spending time in Europe, and some of his early designs. And we went on and talked about, and what we're going to talk about tonight, he's going to talk a little bit about designing specific dunes out at Bandon Dunes, which is, by anybody's account, one of the greatest golf courses that's been made, been designed over the last 10 or 15 years. Also, he's going to talk a little bit about his collaboration with Jack Nicklaus on building a Sabonic there on Long Island. That's just become such a beautiful golf course. The 2013 U.S. Women's Open was held there, and I was really taken by that course and just can't wait to get there to see it. So, Carlos, if you could go ahead and run those, and we'll give a listen to Tom Doak. Part two.
How far into your career was Pacific Dunes Project?
It was actually the lucky 13th golf course.
Is that right? Took you 13 times to get it really good, huh?
Took me 13 times to get a piece of property that good. You know, I think, you know, you certainly get better at this business through practice, you know, same as anything else. I mean, it's a craft as much as it is a planning process. And, you know, I don't think my philosophies of design have changed very much since High Point, really, but the ability to get what I want on the ground, that's gotten way better. And, you know, I've attracted better people to help me achieve that. So, you know, it took a while to get to the point of being able to build something really well, but you know, then it took a while more, you know, but we did a few projects where we really built something that was just the way we wanted before we got a really great piece of land to work with like that, where we were, you know, it was very much in the spotlight because the first golf course had been so successful right out of the box. It was, crazy enough, a better piece of land than the golf course next door because most of the property was part of an adjacent piece of land that Mr. Kaiser didn't own when he started the project, and it just fell into his lap while he was building the first golf course. So, you know, everything worked out in our favor there. And I said to a bunch of people that, you know, the actual building a golf course, you know, it's a year or a year and a half process of building a golf course. And, you know, part of how good it turns out is just everybody getting up and having a good day every day for a year and a half going on, which is really, you know, that's really hard to pull off. You know, just, you know, things are going on in your life and your business and there's a lot of people involved. And, you know, that project from the day we started to the day we finished, everything just kept falling the right way and everything kept working out for the better. And, you know, that's the part that, you know, I've worked on plenty of great sites now, but it's hard to replicate that part where just everybody is in a great frame of mind creatively and it just flies along and it seems like the easiest thing in the world.
What was the biggest challenge at that particular location? Not to screw it up?
Probably. I guess that's what most people would say. You know, I mean, I guess that goes back to my philosophy, not to do too much, not to try to do too much. Just knowing that you had such a great piece of ground that you didn't have to keep grinding on it and polishing off little areas and changing things around and just, you know, stick to, we need to build a really good set of greens, we need to build a really good set of bunkers, you know. It helped enormously, actually, that the first golf course was there because Mr. Kaiser was feeling some pressure to make the golf course a little longer. It's only 6,700 yards from the back tees. You know, everybody in the business had told me for years, well, you can't build a top 100 course unless it's 7,000 yards from the back tees. And I would always dispute that, you know, because there were plenty of older golf courses that weren't 7,000 yards from the back tees. And they would say, Well, maybe some of the older courses can get away with it, but if you're a modern course, you can't build it less than 7,000 yards from the back tees. So it really appealed to me to not build it that long. You know, Mr. Kaiser was hearing a little bit of the conventional wisdom in his year too, and, you know, he's a very confident, you know, he's very confident in his own take on things, but he was still, you know, every piece of feedback that he would get was, oh, God, if you just made it a little longer, you could host the U.S. Open there or something. And I just kept saying to him, Mike, it's just a resort golf course. And, you know, if you want to have a big tournament, you got that other golf course right over there. It's 7,200 yards long. You know, that's where they play the tournament. So I diffused a lot of that just by, you know, playing second fiddle to the other golf course because they built it that long already. And, you know, I understood that most, you know, 6,700 yards in the wind is plenty long for 99% of golfers. It's plenty long for every club pro I know. Just not long enough for the PGA Tour. The PGA Tour doesn't go to Bandon Dunes. So, you know, trying to struggle or change in a great hole because you didn't have room to put a tee 30 yards farther back, so, you know, you'd ignore a great green location and try to build a new one 50 yards farther on, we just didn't do that.
I have not had the pleasure to see Sebanak in Sebanak. I'm sorry, the site of the 2013 U.S. Women's Open last year, but I thought it looked fantastic on television, and it really made me want to get to that area to see it. You had a partnership there with Jack Nicklaus in building that, designing it. On paper, that looks like kind of an oil and water kind of thing, two different concepts, ideas of building golf courses, but it seemed like the end product turned out really well. How did that process go for you?
It was a really interesting job to do and a really interesting process. It's, you know, it was the client's idea. He's known Jack for 25 or 30 years. They're neighbors in Florida. You know, when he bought the project, he, you know, Jack sort of assumed that with their friendship, he would do the golf course. So his company started working on routings for the golf holes. And the more they did, the more the client was frustrated and thinking, you know, that's not exactly what I want, you know. And he got to the point that he wanted to have some other designer just have a look at it. And I had been referred to him by several different people in several different ways. He'd never played one of my golf courses when they called me. You know, they just said, you know, we've got your name from people in New York. We've got it from superintendents in all kinds of different places. You know, your name just keeps coming up. So, you know, would you be interested in looking at this? And I said, well, you know, isn't Jack already under contract? And they said, no, he's friends and he's been working on it a little bit, but, you know, we don't have a contract with anybody. You know, it was the project manager that called me and he said, I'll be honest, you know, he and Michael are close friends. It'd be really hard for Michael to pick somebody else, but he asked me to call you. So, you know, he's at least interested in talking to you and seeing what you have to say. And they said, well, you know, I mean, I grew up outside of New York, and I've spent a lot of time around Shinnecock Hills and the National Golf Links, and this is right next door. And I didn't realize how much property was back in there or what it looked like. Because it was behind a locked gate, so I never went back into the property at all. I said, can you send me a topo map of it so I can have a look? And I got a topo map the next week, and I played with it for a couple of days and did a, you know, started just trying to see how it fit, and I did a routing for the golf course that I really liked. So when I went out to meet them and have a look at the property, you know, I spent a couple hours walking around the property, and I said, you know, I did this routing that I kind of like. You know, I was a little nervous about leaving it because I had, you know, I had no guarantee that they wouldn't just take it and run. But I thought the only way I'm going to be involved in this project is if he really likes this plan. So I gave him the plan and said, just have a look at it and let me know what you think. And they called me back the next week and said, we love this plan. You know, we really like this. So
had Jack looked at it also?
No.
Okay.
No, Jack didn't know any of this was going on at the time.
Okay.
And, you know, so Michael's next step was, you know, he wanted to meet me somewhere and talk about how I could possibly work with Jack. So he met me at Pacific Dunes on my way back. At the time, we were building our projects in, I think we were building Barnboogle Dunes in Tasmania. So I was going back and forth to Australia. And on the way home from one of those trips, I stopped in Bandon for a couple of days and met Michael, and we played the golf course. And he loved Pacific Dunes. And he said, you know, what I'd really like for you to do, what I really like to do is for you to work with Jack, but basically, you know, I love your routing for the property. You know, I'd like to start with that as a base and have you work with Jack. And I just laughed and said, he'll never go for that. And Michael said, I've known him for a long time. He said, he might not, but if anybody could convince him to do it, I might be able to convince him to do it. And I said, well, you know, I don't know how that would work. You know, we'd have to talk about how that would work, but, you know, I'm open to the idea. So, you know, we batted around that idea for a while and finally got me and Jack together in the same room to talk about the plan that I had done. And, you know, we both sort of agreed, you know, we can do this. We just both have to be happy with the finished product. So, you know, if we build a hole and you like it, but I don't, it's not done. You know, from that standpoint, it was a really awkward project because both of us are used to being the one who, you know, once we're happy, everybody's happy and there's no more discussion. And that project, it wasn't that simple. And, you know, and so it wasn't easy. And we both understood at the beginning, you know, it would have been more comfortable for us just to forget about the other guy and run from there. And that we probably weren't going to like it as much as if we just had a chance to do that on our own. So, you know, the experiment, to the extent it was a success, other people had to tell us. Because to us, you know, we're still looking at the 17th hole going, yeah, my idea was better for that one. But, you know, Jack was really good about understanding that and putting up with me not agreeing with him all the time, which, you know, you would think that would be a really uncomfortable thing
How
to do.
How do you disagree with Jack Nicklaus?
It wasn't, you know, I have no filter and I'm not that intimidated by other people. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily always easy, but, you know, he didn't make it hard. I mean, you know, he could have made that very hard to do, but he understood I was getting paid to not just stand there and agree all the time. So he was very good about it. The hardest part, honestly, was that all the people that worked for us had to take like two steps or three steps back from what they normally do. Because normally, Jim Leif working for Jack or Jim Urbino working for me on that project, they would be the second guy. They would be the only one who would be like saying, well, what about this? And they really couldn't have that role at all because it was hard enough for Jack and me to get on the same page about stuff without them getting their input. So where there was conflict, it was at that level, you know, that those guys weren't doing what they normally did, and it was, you know, when my guy would shape a cool green, it didn't just have to get through me anymore. Now Jack had to like it too, and if he didn't like it, it was going to change, and that was hard for them to deal with. Usually they just have to deal with me. So,
and they know what you like.
And they kind of have an idea what I like. You know, I try to keep them guessing on that a little bit. But so it was a pretty involved process. And, you know, from that standpoint, it wasn't as much fun as some of the other projects we've done because, you know, there was more politics and a little more conflict than there usually is. We try to be pretty much conflict-free in building a golf course. But it was a great piece of land, and I think the golf course turned out very well. you know, it's not for me to say whether it turned out better or worse than if Jack had just designed it or if I had just designed it. You know, the client's extremely happy with it. You know, in the end, that's what counts the most.
If you ever did another joint project, is there someone out there that you would really like to work with that you have not, or someone you know that you would be very comfortable working with on a joint project?
Well, one of the things that I've said about Sabonic that it's hard for people to understand is, you know, I collaborate all the time. Every project I do, I've got like three or four guys on my crew doing creative things, and I'm working with them to make the project as good as it can be. It's a huge, important part of why our golf courses turn out well. So I'm a big believer in collaboration. The hard part about collaboration is that for most people outside of the golf course construction and architecture business, they don't understand that part. So then when you bring somebody in from the outside, a player as a consultant or, you know, famous golfer, President Obama, whoever, you know, they don't understand how they're going to interrupt the dynamic between me and my crew. That's a difficult part of the process. And I'd be a little wary of doing it again just because of that, because I think that the contributions that my guys are making are as important as somebody from the outside is going to put in. And I don't, you know, I mean, we'll certainly get stuff, good input from somebody else, but I don't want that to mess up what I'm getting from my own team. So, you know, it would be a little tough. Now, for StreamSong, Bill Kaur and I collaborated on the routing for the two golf courses. You know, we had to figure out how to make two golf courses fit into a relatively tight property where we could both be really happy with them. And instead of just drawing a line down the middle and saying, you stay on that side and I'll stay on this side, we really both worked on the plan for the whole thing so that we were totally happy with how the 36 holes fit together without deciding who was going to build which hole. That was really fascinating for me. But then once we divided it up and said, okay, you're going to build that and I'm going to build this, then it was working with our own teams like we always do. So, it didn't interrupt that part of the process for us at all.
And that was the end of the second part of the Tom Doak interview. And so let's go to our break. And when we come back, we're going to do some quick previews. And we've got a little travel segment we want to get in yet tonight. So, Carlos, if you would, please.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back previewing the tournaments coming up this week. You've got the Canadian Pacific Women's Open, which is at the London Hunting and Country Club in London, Ontario, right across the Lake Erie from Sandusky, Ohio, actually, so not that far away from where I'm at. Lydia Ko has won the last two Canadian Women's Opens consecutively. Of course, she's having another great year, leading in the Rookie of the Year category. She already has won this year at the Swinging Sturts and then again at the Marathon Classic. So she's having a great year. The only thing she hasn't done yet is win a major. Co-Wiz is the only past champion here. You've got Brittany Lindstrom, who's just coming off a great finish at the LPGA Championship last year. And then Suzanne Pedersen won in 2009. Mina Lee, 2005, is in the field. Catherine Kirk, Christy Kerr, Laura Davies. So a pretty good field up there in Canada for the women's LPGA Tour event. You've got also you've got the Champions Tour out in Seattle for the Boeing Classic. Then you've got the Web.com is in Portland for the Portland Open. So this is the last event in the regular season for the Web.com Tour. So guys are trying for the for their being the top finish the top 25 to get those 25 cards. And then the following week, the week after this, the Web.com Tour Finals begin in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with the Hotel Fitness event, which there'll be another 25 cards up for grabs at that. Also, in addition to this, you have some tournaments going on in Europe. So, Karen, I'll turn it over to you. Any comments on these or the European Tour events coming up this week?
Well, I'm mindful of the time, Fred, so I'll go quickly to the European Tour and the Czech Masters in Prague in the Czech Republic, one of the world's great European cities. And a big week for Stephen Gallagher, you know, the Scot, who he really needs a big week here. He's someone who is very hopeful of potentially playing his way onto the European Ryder Cup team for this year at Gleneagles, of course, on home soil. That looks very unlikely now, unless it's something very dramatic. But at the very least, to be in contention for a Ryder Cup pick from Paul McGinley, he really has to win this week or next week in Italy, which is the last event for the qualifying standing. So for Stephen Gallagher, a very big 2 weeks ahead, needs to win at least once to really, you know, put himself in the frame for a wild card pick. Say only two events left in the Ryder Cup qualifying for the European team. And Juuse Lauten, of course, is another player who, if he was to win this week or next week, then maybe he could be in that conversation. Might be a little bit too late for him, but you never know. He's in the field as well. And Jamie Donaldson, who looks like he will be on the Ryder Cup team, he can secure his spot this week with a good performance at the Czech Republic. And Bernd Wiesberger, who, of course, played so well at Valhalla last week with playing the final group with Rory McIlroy on Sunday. Had a bad Sunday there, but it was a massive experience for him. His first real experience of being in contention at a major championship. Now can he carry that on to his regular tour form? This is the first time he's playing since then, so we'll have to wait and see how he gets on. And a player to look out for is David Lipsky, who is a young American player. He's got an invite to play this week. He tends to play out in Asia. He actually finished second to Philippe Aguilar in Singapore earlier this year on the European Tour, so a player for a bit of game. He's only 23, I think, so a guy to look out for any American fans listening. And also we have the English Senior Open in Northeast England, County Durham, at Rockcliffe Hall, which is a big golf course, one of the toughest golf courses in England. And all the European Senior Tour's big names are going to be there. Ian Woosnam and Sam Torrance, Barry Lane, those kind of guys are going to be out playing. And even Paul Wei, who is a Ryder Cup player back in the day, 1983, 1985, and I believe the 1983 Ryder Cup is just being broadcast right now on the Golf Channel. And he's had a he essentially disappeared from the game back in the mid-90s, but he's got an invite to play this week. He's 51 years old now. We'll see who he gets on. And the Senior Tour in Europe, we're now in the meat of the season. The next 2 months are packed with events. Really, the season is very quiet until the Senior Open last month. But after that, really, the players are playing almost every week, if not every 2 weeks. So big changes to come on the money list at County Durham. And also we have the Challenge Tour is in a wonderful location in Geneva in Switzerland. You know, it doesn't get much better than that. Pretty, pretty nice stuff. And the Rolex Trophy is the event this week. And Matthew Fitzpatrick, a player many people now know very well, is actually in the field. He's got an invite to play. US Amateur Champion, of course, last year, and also leading amateur at both the Open last year and the US Open this year at Pinehurst. Fitzpatrick's in the field trying to get some sort of gains now professionally, turn pro after the US Open this year in June. He's trying to get himself into the European Tour full-time next year. If he was to go in the win this week, then maybe that's a possibility. If not, he's trying to get some money. Just try and get into the conversation to maybe give him a chance of getting an improved status for Q School at the end of the year. Say, 8 events left on the Challenge Tour this year, so a lot to play for these guys. The top 15 in the Challenge Tour qualify for the European Tour automatically next season. And I must quickly mention one thing, Fred, sorry, about the Web.com Tour. Carlos, our great co-host and producer of this evening, he has made a prediction all summer that his namesake, Carlos Ortiz, who's led the Web.com Tour essentially all season, he's won twice. Carlos predicted all year that the other Carlos would win a third time on the Web.com this summer, but it has not happened. So he needs him to win this week, and that's it. So his prediction is wrong. So Carlos, I hope Carlos does it for you. And Fred, that's all I've got to say. Oh.
Well, that wraps up the previews of the week. And so, Carlos, if you want to take it to our last break, and we've got some things we'll finish up with here in the last few minutes.
Thank you for listening to the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and we have a little bit of a golf travel segment this evening. You know, we like to talk about golf travel every once in a while, And I'm fortunate enough to be on a swing through some of the better resorts in West Virginia, actually, this week. And I'm coming to you from Glade Springs, which is just south of Beckley, West Virginia. It's a beautiful resort here. I've been here a couple times before. I really enjoy it a lot. But we started this trip on Sunday. We played the Dye Course, which is near Roanoke, West Virginia. It's a beautiful golf course that was built around an old coal mine that a family owned, and they hired Pete Dye to build it. It was opened in 2002. Pete Dye considers it one of his finest works, and I have to agree with him. It's just a beautiful golf course. It was a very difficult golf course, but really a joy to play. Even for a hack like me, I think everyone would enjoy it. It is reasonable. It's not out of this world expensive to play. It is a private course, but if you stay at the Stonewall Resort in Roanoke, they have agreements with the club, and you can play there. So then we played yesterday the Arnold Palmer course at the Stonewall Resort. We stayed there the night. Beautiful, beautiful place. The Palmer Resort course there, much different than the Dye course. Very difficult golf course to play, but again, tremendously well maintained. A lot of fun and a real challenge to play that golf course. Today, like I say, we were at Glade Springs. Got to play here. We played the Stonehaven course, and I had a chance to talk with the director of golf here, Justin Beard, and we actually have a short interview with him. So, Carlos, if you would play that short interview with Justin Beard right now. Thank you.
We are here at Glade Springs Resort, just outside of Beckley, West Virginia, and we're talking with Justin Beard, who is the director of golf for the three golf courses here in the facility. And Justin, how long have you been here?
This will be my ninth season.
What got you down here? How'd you happen to end up at Glade Springs?
I came by way of just college. You know, played collegiate golf at Concord University. Finished up with my internship. Did an internship at the Greenbrier for a few years. Worked a few years in their bag room, and then after that, made the transition to Glade Springs in 2006. They were hosting the West Virginia Open. NCAA decided they needed a full year round assistant golf professional, and then from there it just kind of got lucky. After that, their head golf professional left in 2009, so I took the promotion, and then most recently our director of golf made a move as a general manager, and I took the director of golf position this year in 2014.
Now there's three golf courses here associated with the course. There's a Stonehaven, the Cobb, and the Woodhaven. We just came off the Stonehaven today. What can you tell our listeners, guys that may be thinking about a buddy's trip, a golf trip, why would they come to the middle of West Virginia and play at your facility?
Well, it's real simple. Everybody who comes here once you get here, you're on campus. You have everything at your disposal. We've got bowling. We have indoor pool, outdoor pool for the significant others. And we have things to do for everybody. And then not to mention, we have three of the best golf courses in the state. We've got the Cobb Course in Stonehaven, always ranked in the top five in the state. They're beautiful, and they're all different. The Cobb Course is very traditional. It was designed in 72 by George W. Cobb. Big greens, forgiving fairways, and just, you know, a rolling golf course. Then we have Stonehaven, which has more elevation, something that you are expecting to see when you come to West Virginia. You've got elevation change. You have bunkering. You have a little bit of everything. And then we have Woodhaven, which was opened up in 2010, and it takes Stonehaven to another level. It's more more scenic and more challenging.
I think the Inn opened here just a couple years ago, offers all kinds of great rooms and whatever people might want by the way of accommodations. And as you mentioned, you have all kinds of off-course activities. You also have manor houses and different kinds of rental opportunities if somebody wants a different type of place to stay or bring a group or a family or something like that.
Oh, exactly. We've got anything from your main room of a hotel to a townhouse view in our executive suites, to a manor house where we can fit up to 36 of players in there, and then all the way to your housing, like a Chestnut Hill Lodge and a villa, three-bedroom villa. So we can accommodate any size, any type of golf package. We've accommodated national championships, and we've also accommodated the two-player golf package. So our golf course is just really set up for a golf destination.
And I think now, like upstairs here, I think there's the Bunkers Lounge, which is kind of a sports bar, a great place to hang out after your round, settle up your bets.
Mm-hmm.
Also, great dining facilities, a wonderful restaurant.
Right. It's a perfect bar for settling up your bets. It's a U-shaped bar. Seats, I think upstairs we can see in Bunkers up to 85, 100 people. And then also we have more of our formal dining out of Glades Grill. It ranges from an Italian kind of family style to just, you know, the best steaks in the area. So, you know, no matter what type of golfer, no matter what type of client we have, we can accommodate everybody here at the resort.
Well, this is my third stop here. I've stopped a couple times. Like, I live in the north, so heading down to Pinehurst or heading south, or you're coming down I-77, you're right off the highway. It's an easy place to stop, spend the night, play golf in the afternoon, spend the night, play a morning round, and head on down the road.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better myself. It's, we're 6 miles off the interstate, and once you get here, you feel like you're kind of at home.
Well, listen, we certainly enjoy it. Thank you very much for your hospitality here, and we wish you guys all the luck going forward.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate it.
And that was the interview with Justin Beard, the director of golf here at the Glade Springs Resort. And I have to tell you guys that they had a special dinner for us tonight. They had an Italian, I don't know what you call it. It was a blowout. I mean, everything Italian you can possibly think of. And it was just absolutely outstanding, from lasagna to cannolis and everything in between. I'm telling you, it was simply a wonderful feast. I had to kind of roll myself back here to my room to do the show tonight. You will not go away hungry from this resort, I guarantee you. We're going tomorrow. We're going to head over to Greenbrier for a couple of days, play some golf there, and take another facility. We're also going to do a pipe stem before we head home. So all this is being sponsored by the West Virginia Bureau of Tourism, and to give us a taste of what golf in West Virginia is all about. And I have to tell you, it's a pretty, pretty cool place. Anybody that's looking for a great golf destination where everything is all included, you don't have to go off property. If you do, you want to go down the road a little ways, there's another great property there that you want some variety. It's all right here within a couple hours drive around each other right here in West Virginia. So that's enough about that. Kieran, I think you had a little subject that you got a couple minutes if you want to talk about it here.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. And I must quickly say there that after your description of your feast this evening, I'm feeling just a little bit hungry myself, as the clock ticks towards 3 a.m. here in Scotland. I don't know how you do it, Fred. I don't know how you get through life, and it's so difficult for you to go to these places and play golf and be wined and dined. I just don't know how you can do it, but someone's got to do it, I guess.
It's a rough deal, Kieran.
It's a rough deal. You must go to bed, you know, in tears, just thinking, how am I going to face the next day where I play more golf, have another nice dinner, get treated like a VIP? I don't know how you can do it, but there we go. Some guys have all the luck. But anyway, for anyone lucky to be going to the Ryder Cup this year in Perthshire at Glen Eagles, you may be considering perhaps taking your clubs if you are maybe trying to play around a golf somewhere. Obviously, Scotland, everyone talks about St Andrews or Carnoustie or whatever, all the big Open Championship venues, the great places of history and those great sites that you know so well. But when you're in Perthshire, there's a Scottish golf of a different kind. And, of course, Perthshire is inland. It's not on the coast, so there are no links courses here. So you get to see Scottish golf from a different perspective. You have great parkland golf courses, heathland golf courses, like the ones at Glen Eagles. But obviously, they'll be occupied during Ryder Cup week. However, there are others in the heart of Scotland or in Perthshire. And a couple of them that do stand out if you were to play, and I certainly like them myself. And if anyone comes to Ryder Cup this year, anyone listening, then you can invite me along as well. I'd love to play them with you. And but Blair Gowrie Golf Club is perhaps one of the best examples of inland golf in the UK, to be honest with you. There's two golf courses there. The best one is the Rosemount Golf Course. It was designed way back at the turn of the 20th century, initially by Dr. Alistair Mackenzie, who, of course, people will know as being the original designer, along with Bobby Jones, of Augusta National. And then in the 1930s, James Braid, great Open champion and one of the great course designers in Britain, he was brought in to touch up the golf course. So the golf course is really a combination of Mackenzie and Braid, so it's a fantastic duo of designers right there. And the Rosemount Golf Course is among one of the best inland golf courses in the UK. Greg Norman actually won his first European Tour title at the Rosemount course back in 1977, and it is only 20 miles north of Perth, and it's only 35 miles or so north of Glen Eagles. So if you were to come and play golf in Perthshire, then that's one place I'd certainly go to. A place even closer to Glen Eagles is Creef, and Creef Golf Club is one of the most picturesque in the country. It's situated right in the valley in Perthshire, and it's spectacular. A golf course designed by originally old Tom Morris, and again by James Braid, and he came in and touched it a little bit. And again, it's a 6,500 yards long, so a very good test for most players, and one of the best golf courses you'll find in the inland in Scotland. But of course, if you were to branch out and want to go and play one of the links golf courses, you're staying in Perthshire, perhaps the Ryder Cup. Then, you know, Carnoustie is only 20 miles away from Perthshire. St Andrews is only 30 miles away from Perthshire. All these places are virtually on Perthshire's doorstep, so it's a great sort of hub for golf. You're right in the centre of everything. And if you want to go and play around a golf, I'm going to play around a golf this week at St Andrews. You know, I can go there and do that quite easily. So if you're coming to the Ryder Cup and you don't have tickets for all 3 days, then maybe one day go and play some golf, and there are certainly options there. It's perhaps not quite as plush or as grand as Fred's West Virginia retreat he's went to this week, but golf in Perthshire does have a lot of qualities to it. My own golf club, King James VI in Perth, is very unique, Fred. It is situated on an island in a river, and the only way to get to the golf course is via a footpath on a railway bridge. So that's about as unique as you can possibly get.
Sounds simply delightful, Kieran, and one of these days I have to get over there, and I'm going to let you show me around and give me the tour. So, but that's pretty much our show for tonight. We are available, of course. You can download it at Blog Talk, iTunes as a podcast. We're on TuneIn, and we're also Golf News Net. It picks up the show, and it streams in their rotation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we're available in a lot of different places. We hope you'll give us a listen. And I want to thank Carlos for pushing the buttons tonight, even though he wasn't able to talk and be with us. And also our special guest host, Kieran Clark, who always does a magnificent job. And Kieran, it's been a delight to talk with you again tonight. And I think we're just about out of time, so I'm going to say goodnight to you.
Hey, good night, Fred. Pleasure as always.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.